from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, and this is On Point. The United States is becoming less and less of a Christian nation. In the early 1970s, more than 90% of Americans identified as Christian. Now, only about 70% say they do. But the Christian majority still has a stronghold on the courts, especially the Supreme Court. It's become more conservative, and as a result, it has increasingly blurred the line that separates church and state. That's left many non-Christians wondering about their place in public life. This hour on Point, our increasingly non-Christian nation. Join us, listeners. Let us know how you see the separation of church and state functioning in 2019. Is there much of a separation anymore at all? Should there be? How do you feel about the rise of other faiths like atheism or lack of faiths or paganism? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And later this hour, we'll be talking about wheelchair user Ali Stroker's historic Tony Award win and what that means for disability awareness. But first this hour, joining me in our On Point studio is Jay Wexler. He's a professor at Boston University School of Law. He clerked for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court, and he's a former lawyer at the U.S. Department of Justice. His latest book is called Our Non-Christian Nation, How Atheists, Satanists, Pagans, and Others Are Demanding the Rightful Place in Public Life. And that book is out today. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jay Wexler, welcome back to On Point.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
In the book, you lay out this pretty interesting two-part premise. The first being that as the Supreme Court has gotten more conservative, it has really not just blurred the line between church and state, but there almost is no line anymore. Prayer before government meetings, the Bible taught in schools, etc. The second part of that is that our country has become less Christian, more religiously diverse. By some measures, up to a quarter of the population says they don't even believe in a God or a higher power. So talk to us about the interplay of those two things, the blurring of the line between church and state, and the rise of other religions beyond Christianity in the U.S.
Right, exactly. Those are the two premises that where the book starts. And it raises the question of what does a religious minority or an atheist do in a post-separation of church and state country? Do they just give up and stay at home and sort of give the public square over to Christians? Do they continue to fight in the courts for more separation of church and state, even though they've seemed to have lost so many battles? Or do they do a third option, which is what I argue they should do and they have been doing in the book, which is to ask to participate in public life alongside the Christians by, for example, giving their own prayers or invocations before town board meetings, by putting up their own symbols and monuments on public on government property, to ask for government money, that sort of thing.
And give us what you think is one of the best or at least most memorable examples of that happening, a non-Christian faith that actually got its place in the public square, even if maybe not all the public was thrilled about it.
Well, my favorite story, success story from the book involves the Wiccan quest to get a pentacle, the Wiccan pentacle approved by the Veterans Administration to be allowed to be put on the headstones at National Cemetery. So there are a lot of Wiccans in the military. They get buried in the National Cemetery. This was about 5-6 years ago, maybe a little longer now, and their loved one want to put a Wiccan pentacle on their headstone where a Christian might put a cross or a Jew might put a Star of David. And the Veterans Administration said wouldn't allow them to put the Wiccan pentacle. It wasn't one of the approved symbols. And it turned out that the reason why they did that after there was a lawsuit, some discovery came out, was because the government didn't like witches. But so when that came out, through litigation, Americans United for Separation of Church and State was able to get the Veterans Administration to settle and to agree that Wiccans could put their pentacle on the National Cemetery. And now there are at least 8 headstones in the National Cemetery that have Wiccan pentacles on them.
And by the way, you just mentioned this, but I found this probably the most curious fact in the book that I didn't know at least. You say that there's a relatively, I don't want to say large, but in the U.S. Armed Forces, there are a considerable number of people who identify as Wiccan. Is this true?
I think that's right. Yes, I don't know the precise numbers, but there are Wiccan groups at military bases. In fact, they're one of the things that part of the story that I tell in the book is that there was a prayer circle at one of the military bases, and then President George W. Bush, when he was running for president on Good Morning America, basically said, "I wish the military would look at this and sort of not allow this anymore because Wiccan or witches aren't a religion." So, Yeah, there's a lot of Wiccans in the military.
Jay Wexler, you have said in your book, in this book, that you personally would prefer that there just be a nice, clear rule that prohibits all government-sponsored religious displays and symbols on public property. But there is not that clear rule, and it's increasingly becoming less clear. So your argument seems to be it's probably not worth fighting legally in the court because the court, the Supreme Court at least, has gotten so conservative. So demand your rightful place if you're a non-Christian faith. That's what you advocate.
Exactly. When I started writing the book, before 2016, there was this possibility that Senator Clinton was going to become the president, and then maybe this keep fighting for separation of church and state in the courts might have been a better option. But when she lost and Donald Trump became president and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch were put on the bench, I think it's become pretty clear that this battle for separation of church and state is one that we're not those of us who believe in separation are not going to win anytime soon. So we need to find an alternative. And that alternative, I think, is, yes, demand that all the Supreme Court cases are about Christians, but they're not limited to Christians. And the Supreme Court has been pretty good at saying that the government has to treat religions equally. Court hasn't been perfect about that, but they've been pretty good about it. And that means that if a Christian can give an invocation before a town board, then an atheist should be able to give an invocation before a town board or a Satanist.
There is a case, I believe, currently before the U.S. Supreme Court concerning a 40-foot cross on public land in Maryland. This cross honors World War I veterans. And some people argue it's clearly a religious symbol. Other people say, no, it's just remove religion from it. It's just honoring the vets. There's a plaintiff in the case named Fred Edwards, and he spoke to CNN about the case in February. Here's what he said.
What offends me is that it's on government land promoting government endorsement of religion, and it's not my religion. But even if it were my religion, I would not want my tax dollars being used to endorse it.
So again, he gets to the idea of he doesn't think government support for the religion should be there. Now, the counter argument of that is heard by, for example, a man named Mike Moore. He's a member of the American Legion, which raised money for that Maryland cross, completed in 1925.
It's
been there
a long time.
So he defended its placement to CNN. Here he is.
There's crosses throughout the country. So where will this end? And unfortunately, a bad outcome will end in trying to take down every reference to God, every cross, in every memorial that exists in the country.
Jay Wexler, what about people that fear that? They fear that in the push for more religious representation, we may end up stripping all religious symbols from public property, and that they think that would be a loss.
Well, what I argue in the book and what I think is true is that what the government needs to do is in the areas where there are those crosses, they don't have to take the crosses down. Even if the Supreme Court were to say those crosses by themselves were unconstitutional, what the government could then do is open up what we call a public forum for private speech around those crosses and allow the placement of other religious symbols and displays around that cross. So in other words, instead of just the cross being on government property, there'd be a cross, there'd be a satanic monument, there'd be a Jewish monument, there'd be an atheist monument, etc. And that would that I think would represent the religious pluralism of America much better than a simple cross sitting there on government property. So I think this idea that we're going to take down all the crosses and end up with a completely secular public square is not necessarily true.
You mentioned religious pluralism, and part of what you also argue in your book is that there is we should celebrate that. Why do you think we should celebrate that?
There's so many reasons. I think. Life is just so much more interesting with a pluralistic public square, isn't it? There to have the Christians and the atheists and Jews and Muslims and Hindus, Satanists and Wiccans and Scientologists, everybody sort of talking together with their symbols up. It's cacophonous. I call it religious cacophony in my book. It's messy. But I think it's much more invigorating. It's much more interesting. It's much more educational. I think people will learn about things that they don't know about already. And I think it's also it gives people empowerment. Religious minorities and atheists, for example, and they feel empowered when they participate in public life, when they can participate in that pluralism as opposed to simply believing in what they believe at home while the Christians take over the public square.
Listeners, we're talking about a new book out that argues that as the Supreme Court has become more conservative and increasingly blurred the line between the separation of church and state, more non-Christian religions and even people who don't believe in religion, who don't believe in a higher power, want their space in the public square along with Christianity. If suddenly there were a Christian cross in your town square and a Satanist group wanted to put a symbol there as well, how would you feel about that? Jay Wexler, you mentioned that if there's a Christian invocation or prayer before a town meeting, well, then why couldn't there be an atheist one? We have a piece of sound of an atheist invocation. This is from Greece, New York, a suburb of Rochester. You went there to follow a case that involved a controversy over invocations before town council meetings. The Supreme Court upheld the town's invocation practice. And so clarify for me, that meant they could use Christian and non-Christian invocations?
The challenge was to a practice which in which the town had an invocation before every meeting, and it was always Christian. And so an atheist and a Jew brought a lawsuit against that practice and lost.
However, there was an atheist invocation given before the town council.
Yes. So the great thing about that case, which was called Town of Greece versus Galloway, was, I think, wrongly decided when it said that Christians can give their invocations before before a public body and, in fact, use explicitly Christian language, Jesus, et cetera. But the decision also said that if the government allows one religion, it has to basically be non-discriminatory. And so when all minorities read that line, they started saying, oh, well, I guess we can apply to give an invocation. And so Linda Stevens, who was one of the plaintiffs in that original suit, who is an atheist, asked to give an atheist invocation before the same body that she had sued. And that's what I went to watch in Town of Greece.
So we have a piece of sound from an atheist invocation given by a man named Dan Courtney. And here's what that atheist invocation before a town council meeting sounded like.
We as citizens, the beginning and the end, the alpha and omega of our destiny, are not, as the great philosopher Immanuel Kant warned, mere means to the ends of another, but we are ends in ourselves. This basic premise, this profound idea, guides us such that we need not kneel to any king and we need not bow to any tyrant.
Not terribly radical.
No, absolutely not. There's an atheist saying what he believes, and people learn that atheism is not so scary.
On Point listeners, we're discussing religion and public life in the United States today. Join the conversation. Do you identify as an atheist, an agnostic, a paganist, a non-believer? What do you think about the blurring of the separation of church and state in the U.S.? I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We're talking about the crumbling wall between church and state in the United States, a society that is increasingly more religiously diverse. Join the conversation. Let us know how you feel these other faiths should fit in as the United States non-Christian population grows. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me in the studio is Jay Wexler, a Boston University law professor and the author of Our Non-Christian Nation, How Atheists, Satanists, Pagans, and Others Are Demanding Their Rightful Place in Public Life. That book is out today. And Jay, we have a few callers on the board. Let's hear what they have to say. Susan is calling from Lake Orion, Michigan. Susan, welcome to On Point. You're on the air.
Hi. My comment is the founding fathers had no issue with acknowledging a supreme being or a higher power. I think some people misunderstand the concept of separation of church and state. The separation meant there is no Church of the United States the way there is a Church of England. And to this day, the reigning British monarch also carries the title, the supreme ruler of the Church of England, the head of the church. Our president is not the head of the Church of the United States because there isn't one. That's my comment.
Jay, actually, to add to that, let me just read a listener comment. This is from a Twitter user named Anastasia Beaverhausen. She writes, there is absolutely no place in government for religion. None. How would you square that view and the view of our caller, Susan from Lake Orion, Michigan?
Well, that's a difficult question. I guess I disagree with both callers. I don't agree that what the founders might have thought about religion is necessarily what we ought to read the Constitution to require or prohibit now. The framers, some of them had slaves. And With respect to the question of should religion and government be completely separate, that's tricky too. In a society like ours, where government is so intertwined with everyday life, it's hard to completely separate them. For example, would anybody say that a church that was on fire, for example, couldn't call the fire department to have the fire department put out the fire? I think everybody would agree that the government can put out a fire at a church, can protect the church with its police, can take out the trash, et cetera. So it's not complete separation that I believe in. It's just somewhere in the middle between those two collars.
And Jay Wexler, I want to bring in another voice. This is Debbie Goddard. She's with us from Cranford, New Jersey. Debbie is Vice President of Programs for American Atheists. That's a nonprofit dedicated to defending the civil liberties of atheists. It also advocates for the complete separation of church and state. She's also the former director of campus and community programs at the Center for Inquiry and former director of African Americans for Humanism. Debbie Goddard, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And Debbie, can you tell us, so as you listen to Jay's argument, again, blurring of the line between church and state at the same time that more non-Christian faiths are on the increase in the U.S., where do you feel that atheists, atheism, and other groups of other faiths or who don't essentially have a faith fit into this?
So it's been interesting to watch the changes over the last 10, 20 years. I've been involved with this community now for about 20 years, and certainly the groups have grown, the organizations have grown, our presence in the public square has grown. But at the same time, things like the changes at the Supreme Court and its state legislators have made things scary, particularly recently. And there was a surge of kind of fright after 9/11 when the government started moving in a more religious direction then. So it's a weird mix of on the one hand, we're more publicly accepted, but we're still stigmatized and marginalized in the community, and that seems particularly difficult and challenging when it comes to watching the recent laws and the challenges to the wall of separation between church and state.
This question may sound like, I guess, a combination of idealism and naivety, but why do you feel that there is such pushback against more alternative religions or atheism? Why is it so repugnant to people when they hear that I don't believe in God or I'm agnostic on whether there is a God? Why is that so hard for people to accept that you just believe something different than I do?
Well, I think, firstly, I found this out when I was working with African Americans for Humanism and we did a billboard campaign. Because African Americans are the most religious demographic in the United States, we didn't want to have too aggressive a message. We wanted to be able to attract non-religious African Americans, but not push off religious ones and say, you know, we're here and we're just part of the community. But even the kind of softest message that we could put on a billboard to promote African Americans for Humanism was something like, do you have doubts about religion? Come join us. Even that was offensive to people because you're basically telling people, I think you're wrong. I think you're wrong about something that's very important to you. And there's almost no way around that with atheism. But I think more than that, it's that people are afraid of change. They're afraid of the recent demographic changes in the U.S. They're afraid of having their, shall I say, privilege, their esteemed position in society challenged with, you know, it's lumped together with concerns about immigration and concerns about, you know, LGBTQ people. It seems like a lot of things are different, and the life isn't getting any easier for people. So it's easy for them to scapegoat or marginalize for the marginalized these groups that didn't used to be a part of their world as much.
Do you feel like you're facing an uphill battle or are you having an easier time with societal acceptance?
Societal acceptance is definitely moving. And I think just like in the LGBTQ civil rights activism, we're seeing changes happen. But because people are more public and more open, the blowback is more obvious as well. But it's changing, particularly with younger people. So we don't anticipate that that's going to shift away from more younger people being secular anytime soon. So it's looking, the numbers have been on our side in so many ways. On college campuses, among LGBTQ people, more young people are secular. That's true in the African-American community. That's true in a lot of different parts of the world, actually. So it seems in that sense that it will be getting easier, but we have to just kind of fight the fight, engage in the struggle, and make sure that we don't have our rights taken away in the meanwhile.
Let's go to a caller from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. This is Linda. Linda, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that I am somewhat concerned about the blurring of the lines between the separation of church and state. I think there needs to be a definitive demarcation, and there's no place for religion on the government side, in my opinion. I will also state that they asked me if I am Christian, or I grew up Christian all my life. I'm a 60-year-old female. I lost my religion with the 2016 election. I don't know what you would call me now, but I don't have a home as far as religion goes, because I saw what was happening and I was like, oh my God.
You felt a disillusionment with Christianity?
Correct. Yes. Because it's not fair for the Christian community to push their religion off on the entire American population. That's just flat wrong. We are a diverse nation. That's what we were founded on. That's what I loved about America, and that's what I want to see continue with America.
And Linda, you're saying that as a person raised Christian.
Yes. Who had a strong faith. When I learned that the evangelistic community are the reason that Donald Trump was brought into office, I decided I didn't want to be a part of that community any longer.
Linda, thank you for your call. Let me turn to another caller. This is Kate calling from Claremont, New Hampshire. Kate, welcome to On Point, and what are your thoughts about this issue?
Hi, thank you for having me. So my concerns as an atheist, I grew up in a moderately Christian household, is that I can't be open about it. It's somehow a threat. And I work in outside sales, and obviously you've got to keep it professional, but you know, things do come up and you have to actively avoid it. So, because people do see people who don't believe in a God or a higher power as a threat to their very existence. So it's uncomfortable that I can't be, oh yeah, well you're Christian, cool, I'm, you know, an atheist and we can get along just fine. And that's my experience with it.
Kate, I mentioned
in terms
this,
of
go ahead.
Sure.
I was going to say, I mentioned earlier in the hour that a study by Pew, which is a very reputable group that puts out a lot of studies, said that as much as a quarter of the population identifies itself as nones. In other words, I mean N-O-N-E-S, as in not believing in God or a higher power at all. So it's interesting that if it's true that up to a quarter of population could share that belief, that you would still feel that it has to be kept on the down low.
I do. Claremont's a small town, and living in a small town can, you know, have its challenges, but I think my perspective is that maybe in a more urban area, that's more readily accepted than being in small towns. And that's my perspective. We actually had the town of Claremont had a resident object last year to basically a Christmas display on the town square. And unfortunately, he experienced some pretty awful blowback from an elected town official, and giving out where he and his wife work and that kind of thing. And it was a local, you know, blow up. And, you know, when that kind of thing happens, you certainly think twice about expressing your views.
Kate, thank you for that. And let's go to another caller. This is Sydney calling from Tampa, Florida. Sydney, welcome to On Point, and tell us your thoughts as you listen to this.
Hi, as an atheist, in my experience, it's been that when I open up about being an atheist, a lot of times people of faith kind of see atheists as having no moral compass. So I can see why there is a pushback in people wanting to separate church and state. I believe that a lot of them may think that if we have that separation, then we could lose our moral compass. And I just want to say that just because you may not subscribe to any religion doesn't necessarily make you a bad person. I think a lot of people might see it that way.
Sydney, thank you for that. Thanks to all our callers for weighing in on that. And Debbie Goddard and Jay Wexler, I want to play a piece of sound by the person who's the co-founder of the Satanic Temple. This is a man named Doug Mester. He goes by the name Lucian Graves. And he explained to the organization IndieWire why his organization is motivated to advocate for the separation of church and state.
There's a very centralized, well-organized, well-financed force trying to undermine the very spirit of the United States Constitution and give exclusive privilege to one religious viewpoint. And we're really a grassroots movement without any of that financing and without any of that networking yet. And we're making great strides just because the law really is on our side, at least for now.
Debbie Goddard, again, your vice president of programs for American Atheists. I think people hear about the group Satanists or Satanic Temple, and it sounds so extreme to them, for many people, that they feel that they can't identify at all. They immediately recoil. But we just heard Doug Messner, otherwise known as Lucian Graves, sound fairly reasonable. Do you feel that there are some groups that sound more extreme than they are when, in fact, one of their base goals is simply wider acceptance of alternative faiths?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I really do enjoy a lot of what the Satanic Temple does. They get, as a religion, as a registered religion, they get to challenge a lot of the displays, religious displays on government property by saying, well, you have crosses here, let us put up a giant Baphomet statue too. That's the only fair way to be, and then the crosses come down. But it's definitely difficult when people think they have a clear idea of what a Satanist is. And the Satanists are aware of that, but also challenging that to say, you know, these, we actually have values, we have precepts. You can look at our website, you can look at our groups, we're good people. It's an especially uphill battle for them. It makes me feel a little better about being most identified as an atheist, because I'm like, well, at least it's not that.
Jay Wexler, you write in your book that many Satanists don't even believe in Satan. So that strikes me to think they really have an identification public relations problem.
Well, it depends what you mean by believe. What they venerate Satan as a symbol of rebellion against oppressive authority. So does that mean they believe in Satan? I mean, they don't worship like a guy that they think is Satan, but Satan is a meaningful concept and symbol. And in fact, that kind of worship of Satan or veneration of Satan is something that goes back to the 17th century. So it's not something they made up. But you know, I'm an enormous fan of the Satanic Temple because they use the misperception that society has about what it means to be a Satanist in order to press this agenda of religious equality in the public square. And so I write a lot about them in the book, and I think they're doing more than any – that organization is doing more than any other to demand this equal participation in public life.
You also write about a group, or you mention a group that presumably is a parody group. It goes by the name Pastafarians. They believe in something called the Flying Spaghetti Monster. I'm going to presume they really don't believe that, but they're trying to make a point of some sort.
Yeah, the Flying Spaghetti Monster grew up in opposition to the movement to teach intelligent design as an alternative to evolution about 15 years ago or something like that. And I have to confess, I what I say in the book is I think they're a parody group, although I'm willing to be persuaded that they're not if anybody wants to try to persuade me. But they seem pretty parody-ish. But the Satanic Temple, in my view, is not a parody group at all, except to the extent that use of parody is kind of one of their tools. And it sort of goes along with the idea of Satan as a trickster. So parody is kind of part of their beliefs, but they're absolutely not a joke group by any means.
Debbie Goddard, as someone who works for American Atheists, what do you think that atheists and other non-Christian groups need to do to try to get wider public acceptance? You mentioned the billboard earlier that by atheists put out simply saying, do you have doubts? And even that seemed to be too strong. So what else can be done?
Well, I'm a big believer in community groups and grassroots organizing and activism. And I think, as is true with Satanists, you know, a lot of people have changed their opinion about Satanists when they got the chance to meet Satanists or see Satanists in action, see Satanists volunteering or taking part in a parade or something like that, being part of their community, and they say, oh, they're not bad people. In the same way, I think my belief and my passion as well is working with local groups to see local groups have a presence where they are, whether it's in a bigger city or, you know, more often in the last 10 years, we've seen a huge growth in local groups in smaller communities like Paducah, Kentucky. And we have an American Atheists group there. We have a volunteer director there. And when there can be atheists in Paducah, Kentucky, in the community, you know, being at rallies and volunteering and doing park cleanups and wearing their atheist T-shirts and being good people, that changes perspective about who an atheist is.
And Jay Wexler, briefly, your thoughts on how groups like atheists can become more widely accepted?
Just participate in public life. Let people know that that there's nothing scary about atheism. Continue to help people in the name of atheism so that people understand that atheists care. Those three things should go a long way.
That's Jay Wexler. He's a Boston University School of Law professor and author of Our Non-Christian Nation, a book out today. Also, Debbie Goddard, Vice President of Programs for American Atheists. Thanks to both of you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
After the break, we turn to another minority in the United States, people with disabilities. This after the historic Tony win by wheelchair user Ali Stroger. Join the conversation. What does this moment mean for disability awareness in the U.S.? I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. That was Ali Stroker performing the song I Can't Say No as the character Ado Annie, which she plays in the Broadway revival of Oklahoma. Stroker made history Sunday when she became the first wheelchair user to win a Tony Award. She dedicated her award to every kid who faces limitations and challenges. It was a big moment, but there's still a long way to go in terms of how we treat disabled people in the United States today. Join the conversation. Tell us what Ali Stroker's win said for you. What does it say about visibility for disabled people in the United States? Did her win mean something personal to you or to someone in your family? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And with us to talk about this from Davidson, North Carolina, is Anne Fox. She's a professor of English at Davidson College, where she specializes in 20th and 21st century dramatic literature and disability studies. She has also co-curated four disability-related visual arts exhibitions. Anne Fox, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha.
Thanks for joining us. Could you, I assume you watched this or you've seen videos of the award acceptance and the speech afterwards?
I have indeed.
What did you think as you watched it?
Well, you know, I thought it was a really wonderful moment for disability visibility, both in the U.S. and on stage. So often we think that disability and accomplishment are mutually exclusive, and to have an actress like Ali Stroker up there representing the disability community and accepting a major theatrical award was, I think, a really historical moment.
And when you talk about disability visibility, is that two-part? Is it that we don't see enough people with some kind of disability mainstreamed in a way in society? And is it also that when we do, they're marginalized in some way?
I think it's both, and I think it's something else as well. I think part of it is, in some ways, disability is everywhere, but it's so overdetermined that we accept certain tropes as the truth about disability without thinking beyond those tropes.
When you say overdetermined, what do you mean?
Yeah.
When you say overdetermined.
For example, like on your website, you had the example of Cody Lee on America's Got Talent. And I think for me, in my field, watching that clip, while I found his story very personally meaningful, the inspirational overcomer, the blind pianist, the autistic savant are all typical patterns into which we've slotted disabled people, particularly people with talent or accomplishment that we kind of hold up as spectacle. In the meantime, we don't ask questions about, say, employment or daily life or, you know, the experiences of disabled people when they're not in those sort of predetermined patterns.
So since you mentioned Cody Lee, again, as you said, Cody is, he's blind, he has autism, he's a pianist and singer, and he went on America's Got Talent as a contestant. And when he auditioned, he was accompanied by his mom, Tina. We have a clip of her talking a bit about him before his performance.
Cody is blind and autistic.
Oh. Wow.
We found out that he loved music really early on. He listened and his eyes just went huge. And he started singing. And that's when I was in tears, because that's when I realized, oh my gosh, he's an entertainer. So through music and performing, he was able to withstand living in this world, because when you're autistic, it's really hard to do what everybody else does. It actually has saved his life, playing music.
Wow.
Oh, that's awesome.
And Ann Fox, we actually have a little bit of that audition that Cody did for America's Got Talent. This was in May. It's been viewed more than 30 million times since then. And here's a portion.
I've been so many places in my life and time. I've sung a lot of songs and I made some bad rhymes.
Now, what we don't have, which I wish we could play, is when Cody's mom was speaking. He would weigh in once in a while, but he weighed in a way that was sort of traditionally autistic. He isn't that comfortable speaking. He was a little quirky. So the disparity between his sort of public presentation and conversation and performance was dramatically different.
Yeah.
But I want to make sure I heard correctly something you said. Did you make a distinction between how Cody was presented to the public and how Allie was? Because we see Allie in a professional capacity and Cody, we're not sure about the rest of his life?
I think so. And I think it's interesting that Cody is spoken for. I think it's interesting. I was watching that clip on YouTube this morning from America's Got Talent, and it's 8 minutes long. And I would say, I think between 2 and 3 minutes is actually his performance. And the rest is a lot of attention on the non-disabled people and their response to him. And they're very moved and they're tearing up. And I think I'm not trying to say that those emotions are not authentic. And I'm not trying to say that playing music might not be meaningful for Cody. At the same time, I think the work that the representation of a show like America's Got Talent does is very problematic. It fits into this something we in the field call inspiration porn. Something like Allie's performance in Oklahoma brings forward, it plays, first of all, with the genre of musical theater. I have a colleague named Sam Yates who's written about the notion that in musical theater, very often we talk about the triple threat performer who has to dance, sing, and act. Allie's presence disrupts that, right? She is virtuosic in her wheelchair. Her presence in the wheelchair as one of the bodies on stage from many different kinds of identity also brings forward the way in which Oklahoma and that production can challenge power relationships. So I think what Cody's representation does is fit into very traditional ways that disability is defined in popular culture for non-disabled people's kind of feel-good sentimentality versus Allie's performance really interrogating who we've seen on stage and what we expect from them in terms of disability and how disability can bring new meaning to work.
What did you wish America's Got Talent did differently, or what do you think it could have done differently to present Cody in a way you would have preferred?
Well, I think, you know, it's a big question because I think that's taking on the whole apparatus of how pop culture uses disability. I mean, these kind of depictions of disability as inspirational are on college websites and the evening news. I mean, you know, NBC News did a story about Allie last night. And there's nothing wrong with inspiration, but the problem is when we limit the depiction of disabled people only to inspiration and sentimentality. And so rather than, you know, kind of micromanage how they might have presented Cody, I would simply say, you know, why not present Cody in his own way? Why does his mom have to speak for him? What other kinds of representations of disability might we have? Could we have disability arts in a program like America's Got Talent? There's a really vibrant and rich community of disability and art and culture in this country that doesn't really get much attention within kind of commercial and pop culture venues.
Let's go to a caller from Buffalo, New York. This is Amy. Amy, thank you for calling. Welcome to On Point. And what do you think as you hear all this?
Hi. I think it's an excellent step forward. And I agree with your guest that there's a long way to go in the depiction of people with disabilities in the arts. But I actually manage a program for adults with developmental disabilities that is all performing and visual arts-based. And I'll tell you, there's some incredible talent amongst the people that we support. I know that they're excited to witness Allie's win. We actually studied a production that she was in some time back of Spring Awakening that utilized a lot of sign language and actually a wide range of actors with different abilities and disabilities. So I think it's fantastic. I think she's a wonderfully talented actress in her own right, and I think that's important that she has a degree in this. It's not just some gimmick. It's something that she's worked hard at, and she really does have the talent outside of, you know, in not in spite of her disability, but that she's just a talented actress in her own right, regardless of whether she's in a wheelchair or not. So I think.
Amy, thank you for that. And your line is a little rough, so we apologize to listeners who couldn't hear that very clearly. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Michael, welcome to On Point. What are your thoughts?
Hi, yes. I've been a disability rights advocate for over 40 years, and I use a wheelchair for mobility. And what I see in the entertainment industry is we've made great strides with people of color, women, and some other groups who are demanding and getting more attention in the entertainment industry, and we need to apply those very same principles to the disability community. I think what's noteworthy about Holly is that the role that she was in on Broadway was not a person with a disability per se. She just happened to be a person with disability who was selected for that role, which would otherwise have been filled by a non-disabled person. Conversely, what we see often in movies and other entertainment is disabled roles. I saw a performance of Porgy and Bess recently where, you know, Porgy is a disabled character, but he's very often played by non-disabled actors, and that needs to change.
Well, actually, in fact, Emily Blunt, big-name actress, either has been cast as or is in contention for playing the role of a blind and deaf woman. That's been somewhat controversial because some people have said, why not find a deaf and or blind actor to play that role? But are you arguing that, number one, yes, please give people with disabilities those roles, but don't just pigeonhole them into the roles that involve disabled people?
Exactly. We people with disabilities in the entertainment field need to be given roles as disabled characters and roles as just characters who happen to have disabilities, and it doesn't even need to be commented on. It's just part of the landscape.
And actually, let's take one more caller before we go back to Ann Fox. This is Hilda calling from Frederick, Maryland. Hilda, welcome to On Point, and what are your thoughts?
Well, I happen to be blind. I went to the Maryland School for the Blind, which is one of the best. I also was in the drama club. I got a certificate for playing a married woman when I was, 17? But I don't understand. I grew up in a large family, and being a rural family, we had many, many people there all the time working with each other's fields. I worked in the garden and the fields just like everybody else does. I don't think people understand that you don't need your sight to do a multitude of things.
And how do you think we change people's incorrect perception of that?
Well, I now even live in a senior citizen home. I've been here, apartment project. I've been here for going on 18 years. And now people realize that I'm just like they are. I mean, you know, they'll whistle when I get near a step or something like that. But I just think they're human beings. We breathe, we drink, we eat, we lie down and sleep. I exercise every day. I graduate to Maryland School for the Blind and Baltimore Eastern High School and Hagerstown Business College. And I think that's what the average person does. I think everybody does things. Your eyes and sit in the kitchen and see if you cannot find your knives and forks and spoons. And you'll find out that you can.
Hilda, thank you for that. Thank you for calling. Ann Fox, I want to play a piece of Ali Stroker's acceptance speech. Again, she won a Tony on Sunday when she became the first wheelchair user to win that award. And here's part of what she said.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This award is for every kid who is watching tonight who has a disability, who has a limitation or a challenge, who has been waiting to see themselves represented in this arena. You are.
Ann Fox, there's a whole community of artists that are trying to show that a wheelchair can be a source of creativity. Do you feel like that message is getting across?
I hope so. I mean, I think the presence of somebody like Ali certainly is a help in getting across the idea that wheelchairs are about movement and energy. So often we use this language of wheelchair bound, you know, as though someone is trapped. And it's simply a mode of movement that is another way of expression. I mean, there are dance companies like Axis and Kinetic Light that have explored the way in which the wheelchair can be a form of aesthetics. And I think that really matters. I also want to say that, you know, in terms of her speech, I think it's interesting she talks about the importance of visibility, but what I don't know if this got reported as much is backstage she also talked about access. And so I think in addition to being aware of disability arts and the wheelchair as a form of aesthetic, we also need to be aware of the barriers to people with all kinds of disabilities to artistic training and participation. You know, she commented on the fact that, you know, very often theaters are accessible for wheelchair users in the audience, but not for people backstage. She was in the wings waiting to come out to get her Tony. They didn't build a ramp on that stage. They didn't design that stage in a way that was accessible for her. And so I think the idea of accessibility in training, in attitude, is just as important as people becoming familiarized with the rich and juicy work that's being done from within disability arts and culture.
Another thing she has said in an interview, which I really liked, was she said, "I find it to be fascinating that often people think they don't think I can dance. Who says that dance isn't turning on wheels? Who says dancing isn't throwing your arms up in the air and grabbing someone else's arms to be propelled across the stage?" And it is true. I think we have a bit of a limited definition in our minds typically of what does dance mean. And she showed it can be other things than we might think.
Absolutely. And disabled artists and people from within disability culture have been exploring this for a really long time, both for and within the community. And I think, in a way, this is what has drawn me to sort of disability arts, because it just it expands our notion of bodily variability and what's possible. There's a beauty in it. And so I think that's tremendously exciting. And she, I mean, I've seen this production. She uses that dance as a way to express desire, to be sexy, to be joyful, to be exuberant, all things that in, you know, sort of our stereotyped, stigmatized views of disability, we see as sort of not part of disability identity, when they very much are.
Right. Well, just like in the Cody Lee performance, that song is a lot about desire and the longing to be desired, something that many people might not associate with someone in a wheelchair.
Which I think is a good point, and something that people don't necessarily associate with disability identity. I mean, I think one of your callers said something really important, that we have a long way to go in terms of thinking about disability as a multicultural identity. So often we think of it as medicalized or charity or pity. And what would it mean if we saw disability as an identity, as a source of creativity, as a source of, as a sort of community with its own agency, history, and activist movement? I mean, I have found that personally transformative, and I think it is transformative for our larger culture.
That's Anne Fox. She's a professor of English at Davidson College. She specializes in 20th and 21st century dramatic literature, as well as disability studies. Anne Fox, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Sasha.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poley, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller. With help from Alice Reese and Sydney Wertheim, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point.